Code is never free, because the consequences of your actions will eventually hit you. And if you think that any amount of code is good now, you just delayed the punishment. I have seen people who shit out like 500,000 lines of code via a bunch of agents in a week. And guess what the outcome of that is?
That's Mario Zechner, the creator of Pi, a coding agent that's blown up in open source after Claude Code stopped fitting his workflows. And this conversation went places I didn't expect.
No, actually, it's fucking 30 years ago. Holy shit. People figured out that waterfall is bad. Waterfall doesn't work. And now we're back to hyper waterfall.
Yeah, that's completely ridiculous to me.
And it's worse because now you're not even writing the spec anymore. You just vibe prompt your agent to write a very detailed spec. Inevitably, every time I do this, I end up in a corner crying because nothing is good anymore and everything falls apart. The vibe coder would just sit there with his voice dictation app and dictate what app they want at a very high level. And the enterprise vibe coder will first write a very detailed spec.
We talked about why spec-driven development might be repeating a 30-year-old mistake, how Mario actually works, and it's not an army of agents, and why he thinks running serious AI fully local on a normal MacBook is closer than most people might think.
So for 14 gigabytes of unified memory on macOS or an equivalent NVIDIA setup on Windows, I could have a pretty good local inference machine, and that is affordable.
He also tells me what running a popular open source project looks like in 2026. The number of AI-generated pull requests he gets per day is genuinely absurd.
Instead of getting like one or two PRs per week for a very successful pre-agent open source project, I get 50 to 60 PRs per day by clankers. And each PR has a description that is kind of like a full Harry Potter book. And then usually has about 10 to 1,000 file changes.
This one is for everyone who's tired of AI Hub, but still wants to figure out what actually works. Grab a coffee and let's get into it.
Pi is a minimal extensible coding agent that can modify itself so it fits your workflows instead of the other way around.
I do like that aspect of modifies itself. So do you consider it more, I think you also said coding agent in there. So do you treat it more as an agent intentionally for developers so that they can kind of build their own tool set? Or how do you look at it?
I mean, there's different layers to Pi. There's some underlying low-level things that abstract providers and LLMs, kind of like Vercel AI SDK, terminal user interface library and stuff like that, and also a more general agent loop abstraction. And then there is Pi, the coding agent, which is currently mostly focused on coding, but I personally use it for finances and research and a little bit of my Hetzner server administration is also done with it, which is kind of coding related, obviously. But I noticed very early on that a coding agent is basically all you need to do other knowledge work as well. And it seems like the rest of the industry is also thinking that way. Because if you look at things like Claude's design or Claude Cowork or whatever you have, they're basically all just coding agents.
I've heard a little bit on the backstory that you basically tried a couple other coding agents and didn't really like any of them out there. So you felt like this developer itch of like, oh, I can do better, which I admire that attitude.
Obviously, we all usually suffer from not invented here syndrome. But honestly, initially, I was super happy with Claude Code. It just, over time, didn't fit my workflows anymore, and I had no way to change that. Because Claude doesn't let me do the things I need to do for it to fit my workflows. That was basically the reason.
That is actually the thing that I'm so much more interested in, like benchmarks and those kind of things. I think we're now at this early stage of AI development where talking about workflows is like the interesting, at least for me, interesting. So when you say it didn't fit your workflow, what do you mean with that?
They have a very high frequency release cadence, which means you get 1 to 3 releases per day even sometimes. And with all of these releases come changes to things like the tool definitions, the system prompt, and so on and so forth. So if I have a bunch of let's say prompt templates or slash commands or whatever you say, or skills even, or I have workflow descriptions that the model is supposed to follow, and the changes to the system prompt and tool definitions mess around with that, so my workflows don't work anymore, defined in prompt templates, then that is bad. If the model becomes dumber because they are injecting system reminders left and right behind your back that are not surfaced to the user interface, and I am wondering why the fuck the model doesn't behave anymore like it behaved yesterday, even though it's the same model, supposedly, then that is bad. So I'm a developer. I like my tools to be stable, and Cloud Code is not something that is very stable, which doesn't mean it's bad. Obviously, it's not. Like, millions of people use it productively. So more power to everybody who's happy with Cloud Code. It's just, I'm an old man. I'm used to simpler tools that do just what I need them to do and not more than that.
The fact that the model gets dumber arbitrarily, I noticed the most with Claude for some reason. I feel like I don't know if OpenAI handles it better or where this is coming from, but
I think that's true for various technical reasons and infrastructure reasons. Definitely the harness has an effect on how the model behaves, how the same model behaves. And since they're changing the harness a lot, and since actually testing effects of harness changes on model quality, on model output quality, is really, really hard. Because it's an open-ended kind of question that you need to answer, for which you can't really write deterministic tests. I think a lot of that can be attributed to changes in the harness. So I don't know why GPT models seem to behave better. It might all just be vibes. And
I think this is mind-blowing to me, to be super honest, because like usually developers have like very valid reasons of why they like tool Y more than tool X. Most of the time, I feel I can give you a...
Which is now completely obsolete, but I don't think there's...
Oh, really? No, I could give you like exact reasons of why I like my IDE more than VS Code. I could give you a reason why I preferred Angular over React, why...
Sure, but you will always find people in the opposite camp. That's my point. So if it were objectively measurable, if something is better than something else, then there wouldn't be camps, right?
But that's true. But usually they have like reasons. Whereas like I feel like this conversation between like what coding agents is usually like it feels right. And like also when I look at models, like it's so much vibe based on like how I talk to the model and how I feel it responds to me.
But I think that's kind of similar to when you prefer a specific abstraction over a different abstraction. Like if you have, for example, Solid Shares versus React, kind of doing this a similar thing, just entirely different. Yeah. I personally, I'm a Solid guy. I love Solid. It's exactly down my alley. But that is not because React sucks. Obviously it doesn't, because it's like the most successful framework there is. It's just that it kind of feels better using it, and my brain more easily adjusts to the way it works and its abstraction work. And I think it's very similar with models. I personally, for example, like the Claude models or Claude distilled models much more for prose and things that involve human-like writing than code. On the other hand, I like GPT for code so much more than Claude. So none of this I have evaluated in any kind of, let's say scientific kind of way or numeric kind of way. It's just, this is my experience with those models, and it kind of burned itself into my brain to use Claude for prose and GPT for code.
Funnily enough, I do the same thing. I'm wondering for Pi, what, I mean, like this has now grown into a very successful project with various parties being interested in, but I'm curious, what do you consider success for Pi? That's a very big question, a very loaded question.
When people stop sending pull requests and issues. I'm sick and tired. Success is relative. Like obviously there's an economic perspective to that, because otherwise I wouldn't have joined Arendelle. But it is kind of only superficially related to Pi itself. I mean, Pi is and will stay open source just because the cost to copy is probably very low. The mode here is that I am in control of it and I dictate its design. And even if it doesn't take a long time to copy design, like Cloudflare took a lot of Pi's design and kind of translated it into their new Think abstraction and That's hilarious. I'm friends with those folks, and it's just hilarious. So obviously, if your code is in the open, there's no mode, because people can now even more easily clone whatever you've built, right? But while they are cloning, I keep working on Pi and changing things and trying out new abstractions, trying to find better fits for the problems I'd like to solve. So that's where the mode is in terms of open source software. And in terms of business, you want to add some value, right? So for me, success would be if I can figure out an additional value that I can sell for money, with which I can basically keep a tiny team alive. That for me is success. Bigger success is if I can go full vertical and kind of own the entire stack. But that's a long term kind of.
Tell me through that, what would that look like? Own the full stack. What do you mean with that?
You can think about it as layers. Like at the top, there's the application layer, right? And Pi coding agent would be application layer. You could kind of consider OpenClaw as an application layer, kind of application of Pi, even though they are now mostly on Codex App Server, which makes a lot of sense since Peter joined OpenAI. And there's other applications that don't yet exist in neither in the open source space nor in the commercial space, except for Anthropic. And now, increasingly, also OpenAI with Codex app that try to not only hit coding agents, but try to hit all kinds of agents or agentic needs, let's say, like Cowork Design, Chrome, Claude, whatever. Those were all experiments or even successful products at this point. And there doesn't seem to be a lot that's not tied to a model lab in that direction. There's a bunch of startups that try to do things and then they get immediately bought up by Facebook, who then don't know what to do with them.
Wow. Yep.
But there are no open source solutions for that.
Yep.
At least I'm unaware there might be. So that kind of layer is super interesting and I'd like to explore it more. Like I built this kind of shitty robot here.
I saw the tweet.
And that is just part of me experimenting. What if I stuff an agent, a coding agent in this case again, inside a shitty little toy robot with a smartphone for the MCU, basically the microcontroller? And I'd like to go in directions like that a little bit more on the application layer. I find that super interesting, including local inference. Like this thing, as of today, as of last night, midnight, works fully locally. And it's very nice. It's very super cool. Because now I can expose it to my boy without any second thoughts, apart from this little LLM that is then running on the bigger, beefy machine, being a sycophant and telling my boy wrong things. But that's a problem I can solve in another way that's non-technical. But yeah, this is what excites me. And a success for me would mean that I can contribute to this local inference future a little bit as well. So not just economical success.
I would be curious to talk about that a little bit more, because in the AI scene, even though everything like kind of like it feels ick saying it like that, every conversation that I see is like everyone wants local AI, but it's just not nowhere consumer ready. And with consumer ready, I mean already like developers who are like ready to mess with it. What is your experience?
Yeah, I mean, that is definitely true. And I'm not even talking about the local model quality. The setup alone and the cost involved is still usually not worth it. Like if you actually buy a beefy, I don't know, DGX station, workstation, that costs you $100K, that's a single B300 with, I think, 500 or 700 gigabytes of VRAM. That's beefy and you can run a really good model on that. But nobody has the money for that. So I've been playing around with smaller models, Gemma 4 and Qwen 3.6, I think. Some mixture of experts model. And I didn't believe it, but for this application, a chatbot with motor and camera that is being talked to by a kid, they're more than perfectly fine. Like they're actually really, really good and really, really fast. And I think there's a lot of applications out there that are not just toys, but also real world tasks that could be served by these models today, and you do not need hardware that's expensive. Like, this thing runs on a run-of-the-mill MacBook M1, for example, not even a beefed-out one, with 32 gigs. And there's speech-to-text with Parakeet, text-to-speech with Qwen3 TTS. Those take about 10 gigabytes. Yeah. And then I have Qwen3, whatever, 3.6, which takes another 4 gigabytes. So for 14 gigabytes of unified memory on macOS or an equivalent NVIDIA setup on Windows, I could have a pretty good local inference machine. And that is affordable. Again, not for the entire world, obviously, but for a lot of people. Okay. And you also see a bunch of companies pushing in that direction. Like, Google is really, really big on edge inference. And I like that.
Do you think we will see a rise in the smaller models? And in that, so we at JetBrains, we have been doing the, so basically we ship like tiny models that can literally just do like CSS auto-completion. It's completely offline and it doesn't work if you have like a big S project, but for like completing Tailwind classes, which I'm at least not capable of remembering all the fucking time, this is nice. So I'm wondering, do you think there will be, we will see a shift from these frontier models, which are like massively big. If we're being realistic, also for a lot of these things, like, so I, with my microphone, I had a delay. So I was trying to troubleshoot that with Claude because I'm just too stupid for audio video stuff. You have clearly seen before this recording that I failed because I'm using my old microphone again. So, but like, if we're being realistic for these kind of scenarios, big ass models like Claude are completely overkill. Do you think we will see a rise in small expert, very specially trained? And to some extent, we already see this with like examples, as you mentioned, like text to speech, where it's just like, this is just one thing that you're doing.
I'm not involved in model training, so I can't speak from expertise, but what I'm not hearing. Your head. Maybe, no. If you look, If you listen to people like Denis Asavis, for example, from DeepMind, his thoughts are that the current gigantic models actually don't need all these parameters they have, and that you can actually distill that down to much, 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 much smaller models without losing a lot of output quality. So my hope, not my let's say knowledge, is that this is the future where we try to take these. We'll always need to train. Not speaking in absolutes. Currently, at least as I understand it, we do have to train these big models for various reasons related to how training works and so on and so forth. But once you have such a big model, you can distill it rather easily down to something that's an order of magnitude or more smaller, while still retaining most of the capabilities. And my hope is that we are heading to a future where we don't necessarily have specialized models. I don't think specialized models, I think they can be a band-aid for now, if you want to kind of be sovereign and have some small tasks. But ultimately, you want the same bang for the buck that you get for a big model locally. And I think we are very close to that, actually. Antiras from Redis, Salvatore, he started working on a very custom inference engine just for DeepSeek V4 called DS4C, obviously implemented in C because it's the best language.
Someone is biased.
and he is he's running DeepSeek 4 V Flash on on a 128 gig laptop, for example. Armin Ronacher, my partner in crime at RNTL, also does the same now. He's also started contributing to that. And it's a really, really capable model. Like, really, like, it probably could handle like 60 to 70% of the issues I'm handling with Pi. So I don't think we are far away from models that are as good as the current frontier models. Obviously, the frontier models will always be frontier. But the question is, do I need more intelligence?
That is kind of where I wanted to go with this. Because I think it's very interesting to hear the people that build coding agents, how they also use that. And if you listen to Anthropic, I get kind of PTSD, to be super honest. I don't think it's a sustainable way of working, architecting, I don't even know where to start. It seems to work for them, so I don't want to criticize it. If I look at my workflows, I think the maximum was that I had like 5 coding agents running in parallel, and I had never faced such a mental fatigue after 2-3 hours of work. So I'm curious, how do you work? And I don't mean this in any negative way. There definitely was a certain connotation. How do you work on features for Pi? How's your day structured in that sense?
I'm an absolute caveman. I have. there are two types of tasks I have. The first task is going through the issue tracker and picking off things that need to be fixed or implemented. These usually have an issue that is descriptive enough that I can give it to my agent with an additional prompt template that says, pull down all the information from this issue, including any referenced code, any referenced pull requests, and so on and so forth. Ignore the analysis in the issue and do your own analysis based on the goals that we want to achieve here with this issue. And then I usually get a pretty good analysis of what this issue is about and options on how we could fix it, either by pulling in a pull request that already exists or taking what's in there and modifying it or doing a from scratch implementation or fix. And this analysis step usually per issue takes like 5 minutes for the LLM, for the agent to kind of go through. So I queue up one of these in one session. I open a second session, pull in the next issue. I open a third session, pull in the next issue, and have kind of like a parallel pre-processing of all the issues I want to work on today. And then I just go to each session, check what the agent suggested, go into the code myself, ensure it makes sense, try to reproduce things manually if they're hard to test automatically. And then it's just a classic back and forth until I agree with myself, using the agent as a rubber duck, that this is the way I want to implement this. And at that point, the context usually already contains so many guardrails in terms of what will the interfaces look like, which specific modules will we modify, which tests will we write, and how should they work exactly, because just telling your agent to write tests is never a good idea. Yeah, at least, so at the end of this process of an analysis planning, I just say go implement. And once it starts implementing, which also takes another 10 to 30 minutes, depending on what it is, I do the same at the next session. And once something pings and says I'm done, I have a little Pi extension where I can basically pull up a diff of all the changes that were made and annotate individual lines inside that diff viewer with feedback. And then I click finish review, it gets fed back into the agent automatically. And that's how I iterate on the thing until I think the code is good. For some pieces of code, I don't care. I just say, fine. For other pieces, specifically core mechanics, I usually review every change that's being made like I would with a human. And that's the one thing. That's like my day-to-day thing. Fixing bugs, adding features. And then there are other tasks like refactoring and building new things. For building new things, I just slop Kamen. Like this robot thing, the software for the robot thingy is not super complicated, but it has complexity already because a speech pipeline has many services that need to get involved. I actually took the Python MLX implementations and converted them to Rust last night because I hate Python as a dependency and I want to have a single package people can download onto their Mac or onto their Windows machine with an NVIDIA card and just start it and have everything running out of the box. But in this case, I'm just basically vibe coding. I do not look at the code at all. I have a very good idea of what needs to be done. I can specify that really well. And then I do a lot of manual testing and not even bothering with a test suite because it doesn't matter in this case. That said, eventually I realized this will probably not be a unique project just for my son. After showing it to kids in the hood, they also want one. So I spent last night and the night before refactoring the vibe slop, which is the third the third kind of workflow. Once you fucked yourself by vibe slopping, by vibe coding, and once you realize that the thing you built is actually valuable and should probably have a better fundamentals so you can extend it more easily in the future. You got to go in and vibe, refactor your vibe slop. And there's two ways to do it. You take what you learned and just build from scratch, or you start picking off individual refactoring tasks from this ball of vibe slop. And that is what I did for the robot. And the way I do this is I go in and read it myself, or I let the agent explain to me how things work in specific parts of the code base. For the robot, it was basically two files, one 3,000 lines of code file called server.ts and another 3,000 lines of code file called client.ts that runs in the browser. And yeah, you can imagine that wasn't fun. But I basically just started, like I would manually, pulling things out into individual modules, defining interfaces, boundaries, and those I define by hand. I would, for example, I can ask the agent to propose a bunch of options for an interface or a module boundary. Then I take one, or I let it write example apps or tiny little scripts where I can go in and manually feel how the interface, I still need to be kind of in the code to feel if an interface feels good, if an API feels good. So I let the agent write the examples. I go in and play around with it. And if I like it, that becomes my plan, basically. But yeah, that's the refactoring work. I use the agent to explain what exists. I use the agent to write options for how that could be refactored. Then I go in manually and kind of feel things out by typing up a little code or using the API myself by hand. And if I'm happy with the refactoring plan for pulling out 500 lines out of the 3,000 lines into a separate module and defining a boundary, then I just let the agent do the thing again. At which point, again, we have enough context. So the agent is very guardrailed in terms of where it can go in terms of the implementation.
I'm having somewhat similar workflow. So I'm, but that just works for me at least. And I assume it's similar for you because I have 10 plus years of experience working in the nitty gritty details of a code base, having that manual experience. Also learning by heart, learning the hard way what works and what doesn't work. Every developer I know has patterns that they would absolutely not do again because they tried it once, thought it was great, and it turned out to be horrible. How do you think this will develop moving forward for people that are now just coming out of college?
I honestly don't know. Like if I were a kid today, if I were an actual kid today, like I used to be in the 90s, right, when I started programming. I would probably not learn programming. I would probably just ask an agent to write me a program. I mean, we already see this at schools. Kids use GPT to do the homework. And I would have done that as well because I hate fucking homework. Fuck that.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure. I don't know. So for the young people, good luck. My condolences. for old people like us, agents are definitely a force multiplier, but there is a risk of atrophy and a risk of loss of discipline and agency. That's something I have struggled with as well over the last year or two. Just finding the discipline to not delegate all the things to the machine, because inevitably, every time I do this, I end up in a corner crying because nothing is good anymore and everything falls apart.
That is also the biggest issue that I have with this narrative, that I've seen this a couple times online, where it's like, well, we have too much code now, we cannot review it anymore. Where I'm like, well, then how are you expecting to maintain it if you cannot read it? That doesn't make any sense what you're saying. That is just a little bit more sophisticated approach to vibe coding, but not much.
Exactly. That's basically, it's like the vibe coder would just sit there with his voice dictation app and dictate what app they want at a very high level. And the enterprise vibe coder will first write a very detailed spec. But essentially, it's the same fucking thing.
I had a little bit of like a rant, I think it was like 2 weeks ago, where I was like, I don't get why people are doing spec-driven development. Either it just doesn't click with me, or it's like my way of working doesn't work. But I have struggled to get meaningful information from business people forever. What is now different?
Like, nothing.
There's no reasonable way that I could write a complete prompt that even like I could give this to another developer and they would develop it flawlessly. Neither a coding agent. It doesn't make any sense to me.
No, Yeah, it's crazy. It's like we forgot the lessons of the last 30 years.
I mean, we literally introduced Scrum. Some people
We 30 years ago, or 20, 25 years ago. No, actually, it's fucking 30 years ago. Holy shit. People figured out that waterfall is bad. Waterfall doesn't work. And now we're back to hyper waterfall, where you kind of...
It's faster. It's faster.
And it's worse because now you're not even writing the spec anymore. You just vibe prompt your agent to write a very detailed spec. And that's like a Tower of Turtles.
Yeah, that's completely ridiculous.
But I mean, there's a counter argument to that. And the counter argument is that since code is now essentially free, and since iteration times are quicker, like previously, if you wrote a waterfall spec and had a team of engineers implement that, your turnaround time would have probably been months. Now it's maybe a day or even less, depending on the size of your spec. And then, so you just go in and manually test your way through this or whatever. And I can see the appeal of that. I have yet to find evidence that this actually works for production software. I have my reservations. But I'm not ruling out that there's some magician out there who can actually make that work and not wake up eventually and just cry at night because everything is fucking broken now.
I like to distance my grumpy self from it a little bit, because I'm glad that we're now at least looking, okay, how can some workflows look like utilizing coding agents in a more approach instead of just fuck around and find out. So if I distance myself a little bit, I'm glad we're having conversations around it. I don't think this is the right conversation.
I'm not convinced that Army of Agents works at the moment. And the reason for that is just that if you, I've said this a million times now, I'm kind of sick of it, but if you're writing a spec, what is the most detailed spec you can actually write? What does that look like? The most detailed spec. It's basically your program, the program itself. Okay. So assuming you are not writing the program by hand, because now you have agents, you're writing a human natural language prose-based spec. If you do that, the agent needs to translate that into architecture and code. If you are not specifying any of that on the absolute highest detail level, which is the program, you are leaving planks in your spec and the agent fills that out. And the question is, with what does the agent fill out the planks that you're leaving out in your spec? With the garbage code that we put on the internet for the past 20 years. So that is also exactly how a code base that's vibe coded or enterprise vibe coded with specs looks like. It's very bad. It's very bad.
So I run an experiment. So for full disclaimer, I know nothing about Kotlin, right? Everything in JetBrains runs in Kotlin. I know nothing. I was probably more like a quota hire or something. I don't know. So when the Ralph loop was big, I was like, well, I should give this a try, right? Just to be objective. I have my concerns, still have them. So I reached out to a developer owning our terminal integration. I was like, hey, there's this bug that bothers me. Do you mind if I use this vibe coded and you give me a review? I put a disclaimer because I don't want to add more work to his plate, right? But at the same time, I gave him this disclaimer, and the pull request was never even able to merge. It was just utter trash, complete nonsense. I didn't have any chance to verify it because, A, I don't know the language. I don't know the subsystem. I'm not that deep into the code base that I could justify or have any way to reason about it. And he was just like, fuck is that? Why are we even doing this? So I have various concerns about vibe coding.
So here's the thing. We have a bunch of projects now that show us that something like a Ralph loop or an auto research loop or a slash goal or whatever you have can actually work. Like bun. The rewrite from stick to Rust.
I think there are that's what I mean with I'm excited to talk about workflows, because I think there are constraints where tools like that really make sense. Zig to Rust is a great example because you have an extensive test suite and you can establish a process where you can create or can have the agent verify the work itself to a certain extent. So things like that totally make sense. I was considering making that joke also to rewrite the IntelliJ codebase to Rust, but our marketing department was not happy about that. But that's exactly what I mean. If we're just looking at it, and like if you're terminally online, like I am, you think like, or if depending on the bubbles you're in, around like February or something, I would say Ralph Loop was everywhere, and everyone was like, "Oh, that's the shit! That's the best thing ever that happened to coding since coding agents 2 months before."
Yeah, sure. If you have an infinite source of tokens or money,
that is another. Yeah. Okay. You mentioned earlier this thing that code is effectively free. Is that something you really think?
No.
Because I don't. Okay.
Because the consequences of your actions will eventually hit you. And if you think that any amount of code is good now, you just delayed the punishment. Because that, like, I mean, I have seen people who shit out like 500,000 lines of code via a bunch of agents in a week, and guess what the outcome of that is? Like,
I have so many thoughts on that, because on the one hand, I think if the lines of code is really what you value, or what you value now and used to be your bottleneck, apparently, then you never just really put your mind to that and where you needed to like type faster. Like that argument just doesn't make sense to me. Like if I want to, I can also write 1,000 lines of code in an hour. That's not the value.
It's going to be hard to do it in an hour, but yeah, I mean, I think as a human, we max out at 2 to 3K lines of code a day. But for me, writing the lines of code was never, ever fucking the problem. But so say I build software. My software should have a new feature. I want to solve a new problem with my existing software, or I write a bunch of new software. The most time I spend on that is thinking about it and designing the thing.
Right? Yep.
And then just writing it out. Obviously, there are some classes of programming problems. Like, I always hated writing GPU kernels, for example. I had to do that because I had to, well, that's just hard, really hard coding things where just your brain just glazes out because you can't keep all of it in your head at one point. But let's assume it's not that, it's something else. Then exploring the solution space, the number of solutions you can explore is limited by your coding abilities. So basically, when we complain about, hey, why are we doing waterfall now? Then this is kind of similar when we say, oh, previously I thought so much about things instead of coding, because you had to think so hard to find that one solution that you then can actually spend resources on implementing. And I think there is a big uplift by using agents for that phase, because now you don't have to initially, or you don't have to perfectly zero in on that one solution after lots of designing and thinking. You can actually explore things, and that is super valuable. Doesn't mean that the results of those explorations that are partially or fully written by agents are reusable, but you can get a feeling for the solution space and the solution you want to have with agents way quicker, because you can tell a bunch of agents, go off and build it like this, build it like this, build it like this, and then look at the results. And that is what, for me, is the biggest productivity increase.
The thing that I also like is the asynchronous nature of this. I can now give my agent a task to explore something, evaluate something, research something, and go in a meeting, because we still have meetings, we still need to talk to people. And then come back, and at least if I have the mental capacity to like pick up on that, I saved a little bit of like time in that space that I otherwise couldn't have used in any other way. But again, I don't see it realistically any near time soon that I'll spin up 10 agents and 10x my output in that sense.
Well, I mean, the asynchronous nature is a benefit for some tasks. Like if you have a review agent or whatever. Obviously, you don't want to sit there and wait for the agent to finish its review. But if you do too much of that, at least for my old brain, it's like I probably need to start ketamine or something to get through having 20 agents running. And then it's the task switching. It's the context switching that's killing you. It's previously I could focus on 2 to 3 things a day. At tops. Now, on a good day, I can go through 30 issues on Pi fixing them. And it is, I couldn't do that before. But I also only do this like once or twice a month because after the day of doing that, I'm so done with the world because my brain is just mush. The context switch is what kills you. And I also like there is tasks where asynchronous agents can be super beautiful. But also I find collaborative work with an agent really, really, really helpful, because previously I would sit in my office and think through an issue, and there might not be a human squishy part next to me sitting next to me whom I can talk to. Or they might be remote and I can only chat to them, which is kind of different from regular payroll. So now I have this non-squishy, non-human, non-meatbag in my machine, which I can abuse to become my pair programming partner. And that is really great, because it's kind of like a bicycle for the mind, where I can think through the problem while talking to an agent or asking the questions or having it ask me questions, like the Socratic method. And that helps me explore questions within the problem space a lot better. So that's why I don't like the army of agent things, because it takes me away from thinking about the problem.
So last year, pretty around the similar time, I had Ryan Cagnato on the podcast, and he said a thing around he's basically thinking about problems all the time. So his wife is joking that one day he will be hit by a bus because thinking about a problem and not paying attention. I have that if I'm in that headspace where I want to think about a problem, but otherwise I'm good to zone out. Like if I'm with my kids, I don't think necessarily about work or something or like a problem that faced me. When my mind is going idle, like when I try to sleep, then I have that. But like if I'm doing something and it can be as easy as like playing catch with the kids outside, right? How's that for you? And now I'm wondering also, do you think that will change in such a workflow where you can like have some kind of sparing partner in form of an AI?
So the turning your brain off or stopping thinking about problems, I've never been good at that.
Not good in the sense that you have been doing that all the time?
Pre and post agents, nothing changed for me in that regard, because if I have something that is really enticing, that is really capturing my attention, and say I work on that for 4 hours and then I have to go because I need to pick up the boy from kindergarten or something like that, it takes me about an hour for my brain to kind of let go of that problem. And there's really nothing I can do about it. It sucks. So I would like to be able to just step out and be like, my brain is now all good. You know, like what's it called? One of the superheroes in The Boys, Sage or so, she would lobotomize herself just to...
Oh, yeah.
Whenever she wants a little peace of mind. And I kind of wished I could do that because it sucks getting stuck in this thinking loop. It is probably some, I don't know, mental condition. But a lot of my peers actually share it. I'm happy to hear that you're not affected by that garbage because it sucks.
I can imagine, yeah. I'm not envying you there.
No. And agents don't make it better. They used to make it worse. Like when all this started with the release of Claude Code, I did use all the other things before, Copilot, TapTap, and Cursor and whatever. But Claude Code was just so enticing because it kind of just worked in a way that makes sense for my brain. And then I thought, oh my God, I'm a god now. I can do all the projects I never had time for because this little machine cannot do most of the shitty work that takes a lot of time, right? So I was building millions of projects and I couldn't stop thinking about how to finish this project, where to start with this project and so on. It was like 4 months of not sleeping at all, basically 3 to 4 hours a night. Fully AI psychosis. But eventually I snapped out of that. Was it?
So I think I didn't really have that because in my work, I kind of got pushed into that. So I had like all day to experiment with that. And I definitely had that time where I'm like, oh, okay, I can now work on those projects. But then I try to like cram that in my 8 hours workday as like, oh, I'm experimenting with that. I'm trying these tools. So what was it in the end that made you snap out of it?
Because I found that I'm producing things of no value, neither for me nor for other people. And just building for the sake of building is something I do if I learn something new, but not something I want to do if I don't learn anything and if I don't use the thing I built or nobody else has a use for the thing I built. And so I just snapped out of it. Also, I got kind of bored with agents. Yeah, the lack of sleep didn't help, but that fixed itself eventually. Nature has its way to fix that. Yeah, I don't know. I, I just found that I can produce a lot of shit now, but the art is actually picking what you actually want to build and build it so well that it actually has value. It actually gets used.
There are so many things that you're saying that I would kind of like to pick up on. So I need to get my squirrel brain in check here. You said you like building things for learning. How is that learning experience with AI? Because if I, being realistic, and part of that is that I'm just crazy busy with other stuff. But that is probably one of my concerns. It's like, okay, I used to learn by pain. I've said this on the last episode, but the way that I learned was like, I don't understand this. I force myself to build this, to just go through the emotion, to understand it, look through the source code or something. And you know, with AI, there's just a very easy way out of that.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right.
Great, thanks.
The friction and pain is something I also promote as the one method to learn. And obviously agents take away a lot of the friction and pain. That said, it's also an opportunity. For example, when I learned electronics, that was pre-Claude Code, that was with Cursor still. I already knew how to fucking write programs for an MCU, like ESP32 or Arduino. I was learning electronics, so I wanted to focus my time on learning that, and I still needed some code, but I didn't think that writing the code for an MCU would teach me anything. I've done so much low-level programming in my life, I don't care. So while learning electronics with microcontrollers as part of the circuit, I wouldn't care about the code at all and the APIs of ESP IDF or Arduino, whatever it is. And I would just have Cursor or later Claude Code write that code for me because I don't care. I only cared in performance sensitive parts where I would go in, just fix it up. So I use the agent to do stuff that is part of learning where I don't learn anything, but where that I still need to do to be able to learn the thing I actually want to learn. So there, it's great because it removes a part of the friction that doesn't help me learn something. In terms of coding, it's hard because I'm so old and I have seen so many things and I don't learn a lot about coding anymore. I used to read a lot about software design and architecture and learn a lot of different APIs and build compilers and blah, 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 blah. I'm kind of tired. I don't think there's a lot in software that I still need to learn. At least I have no interest in learning any of the things. Like, example, TypeScript. There's now this big effect TS hype. I don't fucking care, man. Like, I understand the problem you're trying to solve. The way you're solving it is cute, but it doesn't matter. It's just fucking, it doesn't matter. So I'm previously I would have slurped it up and kind of read all about it, tried it out. I'm just tired. So I don't have any advice for how to introduce that friction and pain when learning new things in software. I guess the classical answer is just do it by hand.
That is a very important part for people coming into the industry, like focusing on the fundamentals and not getting like too quickly, too fast, or too quick, too fast.
I understand what you mean. The like, if a junior joins a big corp at the moment, there's a lot of pressure that will not force them, but will make it more enticing for them to use agents. Because first of all, as a junior, I don't want to fail. This is scary. I now have a job. Oh my fucking God, I have a job. What do I do? So now you're resorting to agents to help you be good at your job so nobody fires you or nobody screams at you because you're a stupid junior who doesn't yet know everything. Then the other thing is, as a junior, I don't know how it currently is, but I would assume people who just finished their studies, if they do CS or something similar, they probably are quite good with agents already, but might lack the fundamentals because during the formative years, they already had a lot of assistance. And then the question is, how did they learn the fundamentals? And to that, I don't have any answer.
One thing that I may be a little bit morbidly excited to see, but I think this year is going to be particularly painful for enterprises because there's this devise of like, oh, we need to adopt AI. Everyone, I mean, the fact that Meta has like their token leaderboard or whatever. Insane to me. So I think we're going to see an abundance of sloppy software. We see an abundance of companies failing with that miserably for various reasons. So I'm curious to see how this plays out. I hope the outcome will be like, oh shit, there are limitations. That would be a great outcome.
With the caveat that I also think that a lot of people don't realize how much lower quality they are actually willing to accept. Like, it's not like software has always been this brilliant star in the sky that's perfect. It's usually garbage. So then, does it actually hurt if it becomes even more garbage because nobody cares anymore and just stops everything? I think for specific software, that might be true, that it hurts. For other types of software, it probably doesn't fucking matter. Like, if you have a TikTok client or an Instagram client on Android and iOS, sure, but as long as the videos are playing, you don't care if the buttons don't work or if it takes three presses to like a thing. You don't fucking care, because first of all, you don't have anywhere else to go anyways, because there's only one TikTok. And ultimately, you're just there to numb your brain. So I think there's a lot of software where it actually doesn't matter. But ultimately, I do hope that this is just one of these pendulum things where the industry is going like, whoa, what the fuck? We need to do this, like with Monolith versus microservices and all the garbage. Just on a way more like, just like on a...
I have my thoughts on microservices too.
Yeah. There's a time and place for everything, but first I think the industry always has to swing in one extreme direction before we kind of end up at the middle. And my hope is that this will actually play out like that just fine as well.
The interesting conversation that we haven't really touched on, I have yet to meet a developer who works in a code base and says, oh, this is perfect. There's nothing that I could even optimize. Because we all operate within constraints, and usually time is a very valid constraint. Budget is another one of those. So no code base is perfect already. So the question is then also, okay, what are we aiming for? Are we aiming to maintaining the quality standard? A lot of companies, businesses can probably drop a couple percent points in terms of quality. Not that you can measure quality that easily, but you know what I mean.
I mean, we can measure it in uptime, right? And we've dropped quite a bit of decimal places there.
Tell me how you feel about GitHub.
To be honest, GitHub is in a very strange situation. Like, clankers are now submitting issues and pull requests en masse, creating repositories en masse without the human knowing actually that they're doing it, and GitHub gets the brunt of that and needs to just manage the infra. It's really hard. So I don't think GitHub's outages are related to AI, although I heard some things through the grapevine.
I think, could Microsoft probably maintain GitHub a little bit better as a product? Probably, yes. Does it seem a little abandoned here and there? Also, yes.
I mean, the guy who was the head of GitHub, he was just fucking off into the sunset and was like, da-da-da, I'm now head of, I don't know, Xbox, whatever. He didn't fucking care. He was like absent for months and shit was hitting the wall. And he's just like, da-da-da, I exist. I get a lot of money. I don't know what the fuck I'm doing. That's not good. But the GitHub people themselves are actually very talented. I think what's still killing them is the move to Asia. That since they started doing that move, you can actually look at the outage history and you see once they started going to Asia, or Arsur, whatever it's called, it's not been pretty.
So one thing I would be curious to touch on with you, and you can tell me to go fuck myself, but you have a 4-year-old kid, if I remember correctly. Which is interesting because I have a 3-year-old, so a 3.5-year-old, so very in a very similar spot there. And I'm wondering two things. So A, you have this massively successful open source project while also being involved with Arendial. How does this impact your personal life, positively and negatively?
Let's say Q1 of 2026 was hard. Just because not so much because of Arendial, actually. It's just a lot of companies and people wanted to talk to me all of a sudden. And that was a lot of calls, like a lot of calls. And that meant that I had to see my son a little less than I'm used to, and that kind of sucks. Since I've joined Arendial, my work pace and the number of calls did decrease slightly, not by a lot, but I've since found ways to manage my free time better.
Well, that's good. Glad to hear that.
I have a calendar now. I never had a calendar in my life. I hate the fucking calendar. Yeah.
What? I could not function without my calendar.
No, like anything that's important, people will come up to you and remind you that something important is going to happen. That always worked for me. The world is my calendar.
No, I see. You're like outsourcing your calendar. I like that.
No, honestly, like I have so much garbage on my calendar now that I know could have been an email. And I'm not talking about partners or Aaron Deal. Disclaimer. Like if I didn't have a calendar, it would probably all just be fine. It's just the calendar kind of gives me a structure where I can paint in the time that I do worky parts and time that I do the non-worky parts.
Yeah, this is really important to me, at least, because so I'm also in a very fortunate situation that we have a nanny who's taking care of the kids at home. So if I go grab a coffee or something, I can at least like hang out with them for a minute. And we also have like dedicated offices where they know, okay, Papa is working when he's in there. So this helps me very much be like present dad when I'm downstairs, where it's like, okay, I'm working when I'm upstairs. And the nanny is here for a certain amount of time because we pay her by the hour, obviously. So it's very easy for me to be like, okay, dad mode. But did the success of Pi, except for like the calls aspect, positively impact your work-life balance or rather negatively?
Negatively, no question about that. I've been fun employed for a very long time, let's say. I used to be a free spirit, and now I don't feel like a free spirit anymore because there are certain expectations coming from a lot of people. And I'm not talking about Aaron Deal or anyone with Aaron Deal. It's just once you put out something public like that and there's a lot of users, you can just fuck off into the sunset unless you really don't care about people. And sadly, apart from probably having something like OCD when it comes to problems and keeping them in my head, I also fucking like people, and that's a terrible combination for your work-life balance.
Other than, I know that Rendell, Armin and others are also contributing to Pi, but do you have like a whole team that works on it, or is this more like you're running the show kind of thing?
I'm calling the shots, but I try to delegate, and Armin's become the best junior I've ever had. So I can delegate a lot to him, which is really nice. But the reason for that is also that he should eventually be able to take on my role as well, should something happen to me. Apart from him, there's a handful of people that have been with Pi way earlier than the rest of the Aaron Deal team, just external contributors like God damn it, my brain. Aliu, he's French developer, is really, really great. He uses a lot of open weights models to do Pi work. It's always amazing to see. Nico Balin, a Canadian developer who has done a lot of amazing Pi extensions. Then there's Amaroxidia, who's actually been the developer of Debug X, Debug 64, one of my most beloved reverse engineering tools. And he just showed up and started contributing. Parlance, lots of great people, old guard people like me who've seen some shit contributing to Pi. So that's great. But most of that is on and off. And ultimately in open source, at least at this stage of an open source project, there is usually only one or two people who are actually calling the shots and coordinating things, because most people aren't reliable enough that you can say Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, you're working on this issue. I can't delegate like I could in a company. So
let's slowly wrap things up. One thing I am still curious to talk to you. You have spent recently a lot of time on refactoring Pi. Maybe you have already talked about this more publicly and I just completely missed it, which would a little bit surprise me because I'm feeling a little bit like a stalk on your Twitter timeline.
Oh no.
I've seen things. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
Where's the refactoring coming from? B, what are you trying to get out of the refactoring?
Sure. So you can actually follow it on the main branch because I refactor in main, you motherfuckers. I don't care about you and stability. So Pi obviously also has a lot of historic baggage. It was never intended for public consumption. Quite a lot of parts are actually vibe coded. Like the HTML export that's available, I have not looked at a single line of code for that garbage. I don't care. As long as the HTML renders when you export a session to HTML, fine, great. There are a lot of handwritten things still because some parts of Pi actually predate my use of agents. And those are pretty solid. But with more time passing, there's new things you want to try out. And a terminal user interface only takes it this far. So one reason for the refactor is that I also want to expand into other types of user interfaces more easily. That is possible already with the existing SDK if you ignore extensions. But since Pi is mostly a plugin thingy, I need to find a way how to make third-party extensions also work on the web, for example, or at least with a web stack. So that's one part of the refactor. The other part of the refactor is about remotability. That is, I want to be able to run one Pi session on this machine and connect to it from another machine. And again, this could be possible already with the existing SDK. It's just not as clean as I'd like it to be, specifically with respect to durability and observability and all of that stuff you'd like to have if you can remote into agents. And yeah, the durability and observability are the other big parts that I want to tackle. And finally, I want to be able to use Pi's SDK and just deploy agents on Cloudflare workers or on Vercel and blah, blah, blah. I want the agent itself to be adaptable for any kind of environment, not just a local computer with a bash, but basically anything. And again, this could already be possible with the current thing, but it can be so much nicer.
Do you have a timeline in mind for yourself when you would like to accomplish that? And I mean, like, ultimately refactoring should never be a done thing, right?
Right, yeah. So that's also why I'm doing it on main, because just today I'm gonna start fucking up the Pi AI package so that the most lowest of packages that talks to providers and transforms the context for the different provider formats and stuff like that. So I'm gonna fuck that up tonight. And this is the reason why, and this is why I'm working on main. Like, the new harness is contained in the agent package, and the coding agent package doesn't use the new harness yet, but piece by piece, I will start switching that out. So then you will have a Pi that is using all the new infrastructure below it, but you still don't notice it, and old extensions will still work. I hope to be able to be done with that in a week or two. It's been a slog because I still have a lot of calls and I still have a lot of issues to triage. And if I get a single day per week to refactor, then that's already a lot. So yeah, maybe a week, maybe two until that state where Pi coding agent itself still looks and works like the old Pi coding agents, but all the underlying bullshit is now clean and nice and reusable. And yeah. And after that, I would think a couple more weeks to iron out the new extension mechanism where an extension has a server side component and a UI side component. So you have, I don't know, if you think about permission dialogues, which aren't built in, you have the server side that then spawns a UI component, and the UI component on the server spawns. The server doesn't care if it's a TUI component or a web component or a native Android component or whatever. Just says, show this component with this name in the UI and give me the result. That's basically it.
You reminded me, so we're running now over because of you and what you're saying. I wanted to ask you why Pi is, as far as I'm aware, the only agent that runs YOLO mode by default.
Do you think that tapping yes in the dialogue that asks you if the next operation...
Oh, no, I think... I'm not saying you're wrong. I never said you're wrong.
My thing is this. By telling people, this is YOLO mode, it's dangerous, you better think about this, I actually make people think about that. I actually hope to make people think about that. Because initially people come to Pi and they're like, oh, this is garbage because it doesn't have permissions. And I'm like, yeah, think about why it doesn't have permissions and then think about how you fix that on your end. And the hope there is that people go inside themselves and look for this quiet, dark place that's called security awareness and think about real hard how within their environment, which is different to my environment, they would like to safeguard agentic work. And the answer to that is usually, if I don't want the computer that the agent is running on to be fucked, I containerize the agent, or at least I containerize the tools the agent uses, like read-write files, bash, in a container. That solves problem one. But I cannot decide this for you. I could probably install, could probably bundle something like the sandbox thing that Anthropic has, or Bubble Wrap, or whatever. But these are incomplete solutions. And I do not want, when it comes to security, provide you with an incomplete solution that you can fuck up configuring. So ideally within the enterprise, and then I had a bunch of enterprise people come up to me about that, they actually eventually understand and like, yeah, this makes total sense because you don't fucking know our environment and infra. Like if you use something like Gondolin, a QEMU thing as the container built in, this wouldn't work in our infrastructure because we don't have hardware virtualization for blah, 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 blah. So yeah, that's why that's not in there, because I think what exists in Codex and Cloud Code is mostly security theater. It is now also, Cloud Code now does what? It asks an LLM if a bash command is safe or not in auto mode. Is that good? I don't think that's good.
Yeah. I'm curious to see, because I think like a couple of weeks ago, Peter Steinberger's token consumptions made it online with like 1.3 million a month.
Yeah, I don't even know. Yeah.
Good for him. No criticism there. And the thing that I thought was really interesting in that conversation is that he shared some of the tools that they integrated as automations for managing TRs and like the level of or the frequency of tickets that they get. You kind of alluded to the fact that you're doing that to some extent manually, but you also online talked about the fact that you declare PR vacation every so often, which I thought was an interesting approach. So talk me through how your open source process.
Sure. So I've been in open source for 20 years and I had two other big projects in that space. So I know my way around. Previously, pre-agent, it would take people a lot of effort and time to create a pull request because they would have to understand everything with their human brain and write the code with their human hands. Nowadays, people would just ask their clanker to send a PR to fix a thing they think is broken in Pi. Usually, the results of that are really shitty and not reusable. And often, they don't even identify something that's actually broken. It's usually just user error. So now what happens is instead of getting like one or two PRs per week for a very successful pre-agent open source project, I get 50 to 60 PRs per day by clankers. And each PR has a description that is kind of like a full Harry Potter book. And then usually has about 10 to 1,000 file changes, depending on how the clanker felt. So what are you going to do with that? The default position is you now declare every pull request garbage and auto-close it. So how do I get meaningful pull requests? Well, you ask people to first write an issue in their human voice, no longer than a screen, and tell me exactly what it is you want to do and why you want to do it. And then I tell you, okay, that's good. Now you can send a PR. You have proven that you're human, and you've proven that you understand the problem, and you've proven that you understand the solution. And once I get that, I type, looks good to me, and a little GitHub workflow triggers that will put them in a file that says, this account on GitHub can now open PRs without them being auto-closed. And that's worked brilliantly, because now I'm back to high-quality PRs that I used to use, that I used to get pre-Clanker. And I don't see the Clanker PRs anymore. What I do see, though, is the issues, because the issues, I already auto-closed the issues. But that's mostly just for visual reasons. I still every day go to the issue tracker, to the closed issues, find the issue that's labeled last red. That's kind of like the marker up until which either me or Armin have processed issues. And then I painstakingly read through 30 to 60 issues that have been submitted in the last, whatever, 12 or 24 hours and identify, is this Clanker? Is this not Clanker? Is it a good issue? Is it not a good issue? And then I reopen the issues that are worth it. And out of this, like my last triage run was 2 days ago, because thankfully Armin is now doing that as well. I think I ran through 50 issues and two survived. Two issues got opened out of 50 closed issues. But it works. I mean, I spent about half an hour going through 50 issues, because most are very quickly to identify as garbage. So that's not hard. It sucks that I have to do it, but it's not that bad. For Peter and Openclaw, the scale is just orders of magnitude bigger. And my version, my method would not work for that at all. No chance. So that is why he is trying to combat that with automated tools. Actually, earlier in February, I wrote some things for the team, for the OpenClaw team, to visualize issues in a 3D space and be able to select clusters of issues that are very, very likely the exact same issue, just to bulk select them and close them and replace them with a summary of that cluster of issues. But that still didn't work, because the number of issues just exploded. And even with that, where you can select 50 issues that are the same and just say this is not one issue, even with that, they couldn't handle it. So now Peter's very aggressive in automating as much as possible. And that is, he's kind of living in the future.
I think it's very interesting to hear him talk and like his experiments and also experience. I'm very fascinated by some of the things. I still don't believe that most people or companies are anywhere near that.
No. Anthropic probably is with Cloud Code.
True,
it's probably
true,
very similar.
But I mean, if I would now go, I worked in Germany, so I worked for energy and health. I worked for Siemens for a while.
That's not going to fly there at all.
If I would suggest, I'm like, hey, how do you feel about like spending $1.3 million for a development team of three people? I don't think they would be super amused by that.
Yeah, it's hard to say. So first of all, the $1 million is API pricing, right? And as if you're working for OpenAI, API pricing is not really the it's not really what OpenAI paid for Peter's work for that month. Let's put it that way. Okay, but even if you assume they had a margin of 90% and the actual cost was $100,000 for that 1 month, then the question is, was it worth the money? And I cannot speak to that for OpenClaw at all. Like I would trust Peter enough to know what he's doing, and that money was probably well spent in terms of, I'm not sure how far along he is with kind of automating a lot of this stuff, but I would assume a lot of that money was spent on building the automation infrastructure. So in the future, they do not have to spend as much anymore on that kind of thing. But again, I don't know enough about OpenClaw too.
One thing you touched on though is, again, interesting to me, because I think, I mean, we all know that the cost that we have right now for tokens is going to increase long term. Long term, hard to say, but at least like, in some future, there's a price hike going to come. So
for the subscription, yes.
Yes.
For the pay-as-you-go API tokens, you also think that there's going to be more price hikes? I'm not disputing that. I'm just asking.
I'm not sure how... I have some trust issues with all of them, to be super honest.
Yeah, me too.
So I could still consider there like some kind of marketing budget being allocated to even those where you say like, okay, adoption is still important to us. We want to be a little bit more financially responsible, but still, I don't know about that. But like, I mean, subscription unknown fact that those are subsidized tokens left and right. I think once those subscription costs are going to increase, companies are going to question more at the ROI of certain initiatives and endeavors and usages of AI. So I'm wondering, and again, it partially brings up the conversation around workflows and stuff like that, but I would not be surprised if we see a future, and this is just completely me speculating, where different seniority levels get a different budget allocation for AI.
Oh, that's already the case. I know companies where this is already the case. Yeah.
Same. But at the same time, then if there's also the conversation, because right now it feels a little bit like an unlimited pot of gold that a lot of companies allocate to AI, which I think to some extent makes sense for people to experiment and get into the AI psychosis and past it.
Yeah.
But with that, when there we start the conversation of like, oh, do you really need to use Opus for centering that diff now? Probably not. And I do that myself. I'm too lazy to switch models, so I usually pick one that works for me reliably. I usually use GPT-5.5 and call it a day. I also don't dramatically mess with different reasoning levels, so I think that might be biased, but I think that's the case for most developers, but I don't think that would be the case long-term just for price sensitivity. Thoughts?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, we were promised lower token pricing for the past 2 years, and I do not see that happening for the frontier models. Like the last couple of releases always increased pricing. Or they changed the tokenizer so that now for the same input text, they just count more tokens. Which is super extra sneaky. Yeah, same token price, but it's just like 1.4 times more tokens for the same input. There's technical reasons why you want to switch out your tokenizer. But it's also kind of, I don't know, suspicious, specifically pre-IPO. So
the thing that boggles my mind is you're marketing these things to developers right now because like...
Oh, they stopped marketing to developers. They are now marketing to CIOs and enterprises.
I guess.
They don't care about developers anymore because you know what happened? They marketed to developers for the past year, 2025, basically. From April to October, they got all the training data for them in exchange for paying Anthropic $200 for that privilege. Then they improved the models with that data. Then over Christmas, they gave everybody AI psychosis in form of free coupons that you can share with your friends to try out Cloud Code during Christmas break. And then in January, everybody came back to the office and said, boss, we need to buy the clouds, all the clouds. And then all the companies started buying the clouds. And this is what happened. And at that point where the companies start requesting more clouds, Anthropic doesn't have to gather to the developers anymore. And you can see it in all their actions since February. I think the token prices will not decrease. At least not for frontier models. But what's interesting is if you look at the token prices for open weights models at similar sizes than what's been published about the sizes of closed source frontier models, there's a lot of margin those motherfuckers make on inference.
That is true.
So, yeah.
That's true. Yeah, I don't know. Thank you so much for joining me for this. I had a fantastic time being grumpy with you about certain things.
Yeah. Right now. The grumpy show.
Should rename this. Thank you so much. Really appreciate you. And also thank you so much for doing the work that you're doing on Pi. It's definitely
so
one of the agents. Well, I like using it myself. So thank you.
But thanks for having me. And best of luck with the tokens and stuff.
All right. See you next time. Bye.
Bye.